Before moving on this week to explore more about emptiness and wisdom, I just want to recap a little bit of some of the things that we've touched on in the first 2 weeks of being here. So in the first week, Maitreya Bandhu was talking about, well, he said that Buddhism begins, hello, come on in. Do find yourself cushions and make yourself comfortable. Yeah, Maitreya Bandhu said in the first week that Buddhism begins in a way in two places. It begins with our mind and what's happening in our mind right now. So it begins right here with our current experience. And it also begins with shunyata, with the ultimate of Buddhist wisdom. And in a way, it begins with enlightenment, and it begins with where we are now. That's what Maitreya Bandhu was saying. And in between those two poles, if you like, is the whole of the Buddhist path. It's the whole of the Buddhist path with all the teachings that lead from our mind as it is now to the mind of a Buddha, to the enlightened mind. So in this course, we're going to primarily be looking from the enlightened mind downwards. So we're looking at what the Buddha has to say about the nature of things, the nature of reality. But most of Buddhism is about the path that moves us from where we are now to that enlightened perspective. And Maitreya Bandhu talked of the path, well, the Buddha talked of the path. Maitreya Bandhu talked in terms of the threefold path, which is ethics, meditation and wisdom, sila, samadhi, pranaya. And you could say that, no, I won't say that, it's ethics, meditation and wisdom. He also talked about dukkha, didn't he? Can anybody remember what he said about dukkha? Or what dukkha is?
Three forms.
Yeah.
Three forms of unsatisfaction.
Yeah, three forms of unsatisfaction. So that's one formulation. Can you remember what they were?
I think one of them was the unsatisfactory being aware that something's deeply wrong.
Yeah. A sort of existential unsatisfactoriness with experience of life. That there's something that doesn't fit. So that's in a way the most subtle level of unsatisfactoriness, this sense that no matter what happens, even if we get what we want, even if life really works out in all the ways that it's supposed to work out, it doesn't quite hit the spot. It doesn't fulfill completely. There's always a part of us that wants more, or isn't quite satisfied, or is wondering is anxious about when what we've got will end, or there's something that won't be fulfilled in our current state of mind. So that's one type of dukkha. Another type of dukkha?
The unsatisfactoriness of not being enlightened. Not being aware of dukkha.
Yeah, that's true, but I'd group that in with this one that we've been talking about. The other two are, there's dukkha-dukkha, which is just physical suffering and ordinary, as it were, suffering of pain, physical distress. It also includes mental distress, so we can get into hellish mental states, can't we, and well, depression or I don't know, some sort of neurosis or hellish mental states that the mind can create, but also physical pain that the body is subject to, and all of us are subject to at some point. So that's the sort of basic level of unsatisfactoriness that the world, that our bodies experience pain, our mind is subject to pain, at least potentially. And then the second type of dukkha is suffering because things don't last. So even when we get what we want, it's impermanent. Everything's impermanent, and we're impermanent, and there's a subtle, or maybe sometimes not so subtle, degree of dukkha associated with the fact that we can't fix our lives to last in the way that we want them. Even if we get everything together for a while, it falls apart. There's entropy, isn't there? Everything continues to fall apart. And when we reach a certain age, we realise that that's applying to our bodies as well. It won't stay in the way that we want it to. And ultimately, we're impermanent. So there's an unsatisfactoriness in that. So it's three kinds of dukkha. What Maitreya went on to say is that actually there's a way out of this. So the Buddha talked about a way out of this. All three kinds of dukkha, there's a way out, but particularly there's a way out of the mental pain that we cause ourselves. As long as we've got a body, there will be physical pain. But the enlightened mind doesn't have any mental pain. And there's a way out of that. And that is to do with seeing things from a wisdom perspective, from seeing things as they really are. And it's because we don't see things as they really are that we cause ourselves unnecessary mental pain. The physical pain might be unavoidable, but the mental pain is avoidable, and we cause it to ourselves. Maitreya Bandhu talked about, do you remember this, being in a darkened room, in a strange room, thinking that you were in your own bedroom, and you're not, and you go around bumping into things. That's because we don't see our situation. We have an approximate idea of it, and the approximate idea doesn't quite work. And that's how we are in life. We have an approximate idea of who we are, what life is about, but we've somehow got it wrong. And from a Buddhist perspective, we've got it very, very wrong. In fact, we've got it completely upside down. So in a way, we're not even in a hotel room. We're somewhere completely other than that. Yeah, and no wonder we keep bumping into things. So there is a way out, and it involves seeing things as they really are. And that requires a particular type of mind. So the thing about Buddhism is that the truths of the world aren't like facts that you can just read in a newspaper, or they're not like scientific truths that you can study. They're truths about the way that we perceive things. And because our perception depends on our state of mind, we have to change the type of mind that we've got in order to perceive things as they really are. So we have to change ourselves in order to see reality. Yeah? And mind has depth. Maitreya Bandhu was making the point that mind has depth. We've got to go deeper. It's not all on this level of finding out more information. So wisdom isn't more knowledge. That's what he was saying. Do you remember? Wisdom isn't more knowledge. It's not about being intelligent. It's not about knowing more things. It's about being able to see things in depth, and we have to train in that. And part of that training involves studying, part of it involves meditation, and part of it involves ethics. So it's wisdom, meditation, and ethics. And the ethics is important because if our mind isn't pure, if our conscience isn't clear, if our heart isn't open, then we won't be able to go into depth in meditation. So you've got, in a way, the path beginning from purifying our heart and mind. And we said that Vajrasattva was, in a way, a representation, a symbol for the whole of that path, from ethics, the purity of a pure mind, all the way through to wisdom. If Shunyata was personified as a symbol, it would be the shining, radiant, white light of purity that is Vajrasattva. Okay. And we talked last week about the levels of wisdom. Do you remember the three levels? I've just mentioned the three levels of wisdom. Well, there was listening, reflecting, and meditating. Maitreya Bandhu talked about how we listen. Do you remember the different pots? The pots, you know, the cracked pot, the leaky pot. No, the cracked pot was the leaky pot. The pot that was over full, already full. And the poisoned pot. Do you remember the poisoned pot? That, anything that went in, because it was so full of poisoned. It was just corrupted, contaminated.
Actually, others
of
what
sort? Of wisdom. So that was listening, reflecting, and becoming. Sometimes translated the last one as meditating. So listening was where he was talking about these three pots, that we've got to really have a pot that's whole and empty, receptive, and not full of poison. So we've got to, in a way, purify ourselves even before we can listen. And then there's meditating, and then then there's reflecting, and then there's becoming, actually experiencing for ourselves what Buddhism is saying. So we talked about those three levels of wisdom, and then I talked about Shraddha. Do you remember Shraddha as this confidence trust that we're trying to engender, we're trying to develop, and that's really, really vital. In fact, it's so vital, it's a prefiguration of wisdom itself. So as we develop more confidence trust, that shades into seeing things as they really are. So I talked about these three types of Shraddha. Can anybody remember what they were? You're not taking notes, are you?
Intuition, reason, and experience.
Oh yeah, well that's good actually. That wasn't what I had in mind, but I did talk about those. That's right, Femi. So intuition, reason, and experience. So they're not three types of Shraddha so much as three ways of developing Shraddha, using our intuition, building on that with our reason. I'll come on to that. There's something else I said about the three faiths. You're all suddenly alive and all talking at once. That's right. So between you had them. Who said what? Go on.
Longing
faith.
Lucid faith.
Lucid faith. And
deep faith.
Well done. Yeah, well done. So deep faith was a deep conviction of what is real. A deep faith was a deep conviction about truth. When we encounter what is real, what is true, there's a conviction that can arise. So it's a deep faith in what is real, what is true. Lucid faith was lucidity in what has value. So it's this emotion that responds to value. In a way, it's like a clarity. Do you remember I talked about the water purifying gem that purifies water? It's a clarity, a lucidity, when we have a system of values, when we know what's up and what's down. We can have a clarity as to where we stand. Okay? So there's lucidity as to what has value. And longing for what's possible. So the longing faith was not only recognizing what values there are in the universe and what's true in the universe, but the longing faith included this sense that it was possible for us to realize and actually become truth and value, embodiments of truth and value. Okay, so we then talked a wee bit about how we cultivate Shraddha. I talked about wonder. Do you remember Niagara Falls featured and Vajrasattva featured, and we ended with chanting the Vajrasattva mantra. So I want to move on from Shraddha to talking now about the essence of the Buddha's insight into the way things are, at least as it's conceptualized. This is the heart of Buddhist wisdom. Yeah, the pithy heart of Buddhist wisdom. All forms of Buddhism, whether they're Tibetan Buddhism or Sri Lankan Buddhism or Japanese Buddhism, all forms of Buddhism have this teaching at their basis, at their very essence, as their very heart. And if they don't, then they're not Buddhism. Yeah. So sometimes people say, what's the difference between this faith? Like Hinduism can seem very close to Buddhism, but it doesn't have this teaching at its very heart. Yeah. So what is this teaching? Well, the teaching is called conditioned co-production, or praticca samuppada, which is sometimes translated in this rather technical term of conditioned co-production, or the truth of conditioned arising. And I'm going to tell you a formulation of it, and then we're going to explore it. So a formulation of it is that all things arise independent upon conditions. All things arise independent upon conditions. And when those conditions die away, all things die away, all things cease. So the Buddha put it in one formulation, he put it as this being that becomes. On the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that not does not become. On the ceasing of this, that ceases. So there's arising and ceasing. And he's saying that arising and ceasing happen dependent upon other conditions. Everything arises, everything ceases, and all that arising and ceasing is a flow of conditions. Yeah? This being, that becomes. On the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. On the ceasing of this, that ceases. So you can say, so what? You can say, so what? What is so profound about that? It seems a bit like a scientific formula. Well, perhaps not even as interesting as a scientific formula. It seems a bit bland or banal even. Possibly. One of the Buddha's disciples, Ananda, once said to the Buddha, the truth of dependent origination seems very obvious to me. I mean, what's the big deal? He didn't use those words. He said it seemed ever so plain. ever so plain and clear. So everything arises and ceases. What's the big deal? And the Buddha said, say not so, Ananda, say not so. This truth is hard to see. It's really hard to see. And it's because beings in this world don't see it in its entirety, in its depth, that they become entangled in life and cause themselves pain. They become entangled like a ball of twine, he said, but through not seeing this truth. It's really hard to see. So I think there is lots of ways into exploring this, but I'm just going to clarify a little bit about what conditioned co-production means, and then we'll have a cup of tea. So the first thing to remember is that the formula isn't it. The formula is not it. Otherwise, I've said it twice, actually, and we'd all be enlightened, particularly those of you who've written it down. So the formula can't be it, can it? It's not the experience. Hopefully, the Buddha was getting at something beyond those formulaic kind of words. He was getting at an experience, and that experience is said to be ineffable, i.e. it's said to be beyond all concepts. There's no conceptual formulation, no words that can fully describe this experience. This experience is beyond all concepts. Yeah? All concepts. Actually, all experience is beyond all concepts, isn't it? Yeah? There's no words that can fully describe the taste of Italian ice cream. Yeah? There's an ice cream parlour that's opened just down the road that's open till midnight, so you can have an ice cream on the way home. And there's no words that can describe it. There's no concepts. There's no words or concepts that can even describe just a cup of tea and what that tastes like, or actually any experience. Let alone this enlightened experience that's said to transcend space, time, subject, object, all notions of duality, self, other, etc. So the enlightenment experience is ineffable. But the Buddha was trying to point to it. So at first, when he became enlightened, he thought he wasn't going to be able to point to it. He thought that it's so indescribable, so incredible, so out of any ordinary kind of conceptual structure that we've got, that he wasn't going to be able to do it. Later, he changed his mind out of compassion. In the legend, he was asked to change his mind by one of the gods who came down and said, please, out of compassion, there are some people who will understand. And what he did was he tried to conceptualize it in words. And the most general conceptualization that there is what I've just said, of conditioned co-production. This being, that becomes. On the rising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. On the ceasing of this, that ceases. If he'd said any more, it said that he would have got into saying too much, and people would have misinterpreted him. If he'd said any less, he would have had to remain silent, and people wouldn't have had a start. So in a way, it's said to be the most you can say without getting it wrong. But even then, it's not it. It's pointing to something. It's beyond the formula. So at the one level, you've got this ineffable experience. Then you've got this formula of conditioned co-production that is very abstract, very general. Its merit is in the fact that it's abstract and general, in that it's applicable to every experience that is possible. It's applicable to the whole universe and all that's within that universe. So it's applicable to everything. So that's why it's so powerful. But at the same time, because it's so general, it can be really abstract. And so then what Buddhism did was it made more particular, specific examples and applications of that general teaching. So can anybody think of a specific application of that general teaching?
If it rains, you get wet.
That's right. So that might be a kind of cause and effect link. What I was thinking of, though, was in Buddhism itself, there were some specific applications. So, for example, the Four Noble Truths. Claudia. So the Four Noble Truths are that there is the experience of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness in life, and that's a universal experience, there is dukkha. And then the Buddha said, well, he said that what are the conditions that lead to dukkha? If there is this experience of dukkha, and everything arises in dependence upon conditions, what are the conditions upon which dukkha arises? And he saw that the main condition for the arising of dukkha was, what was it?
Craving.
So it was this wanting that we have. Particularly, it was this wanting for experience, some sort of experience which arises as soon as we have a sense of self. So then he said, he turned it around and said, if dukkha is a conditioned thing, it can not only arise dependent upon conditions, but it can cease if those conditions are taken away. So then the third noble truth is the ending of dukkha. It can end, it can cease, if craving ceases. So it's like an application of this formula. You look for what is it that causes, what are the conditions that causes a particular phenomenon, and then you can look at what if it's a phenomenon that you don't want, what can cease, what conditions can cause it to cease. And then he said, okay, well, what causes craving to cease? If craving is the condition for dukkha and we want to get rid of dukkha, what will cause craving to cease? And he came, well, to the conclusion it was the Noble Eightfold Path. In this standard formula, it's the Noble Eightfold Path. So if you put this path into practice in your life, then craving can cease and dukkha will cease. So that's a very specific application to this experience of dukkha, of this more general principle that things arise in dependence upon conditions, and when those conditions are taken away, the thing ceases, whatever it was ceases, the experience ceases. Okay, so I'm still aware that that's still quite abstract, and when we come back after tea, we're going to look at it in a bit more practical detail in terms of what does this actually mean. And also to try and get a bit of a sense of the breadth of this teaching, the scope and wonder and depth of this teaching. Because even after what I've said, it's not easy to see why it's such an important teaching. So I'm going to explore that a bit more. We'll explore that a bit more.